Welcome back to WPPA Sports Saturdays. We're joined by a gentleman that's known near and far as, he's a member of the all-vet team for the Philadelphia Phillies. First baseman on the 93 team that went on to the World Series. Also, a best-selling author of a book that I had read and cherished and now can't find. He ain't an athlete, lady, but joining us now on the program is John Kruk. Good morning, John, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, our pleasure. You know, when you take a look at everything that you've been able to accomplish in baseball and in life, and, you know, making it to the MLB Network as an analyst, now an analyst for NBC Sports in Philly with the Philadelphia Phillies, you know, you've seen the game from all sides. You've also been a coach in the organization. And, you know, when you take a look at baseball from when you played till now, there's some difference, but it's still baseball, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, you still got to hit it. You still got to catch it. Still got to pitch it. If you don't do those things, you ain't going to win. But, yeah, you know, the players are different. And I think, well, I know that they're bigger, stronger, faster. They train differently than we ever did back then. And, you know, I think guys are, some pitchers could be a hindrance, but they're more prepared as far as statistical data goes with every game they go into, every pitcher that comes into that game. They're more informed, and sometimes, paralysis by analysis, some guys fall into that category. I know personally I wouldn't have liked all that information. Some of it would have been great, but all of it, I'm not that smart.
You know, one thing I noticed in your job now on television, you break it down into the understanding of the everyday baseball fan, where some guys, they talk about that damn exit velocity and, you know, all that nonsense and the angle of the launch angle and all that stuff. It's still a home run is a home run is a home run, right?
Well, you'd think. I was under the impression as a hitter, and, you know, I had a great minor league hitting coach, Jack Maloof. Tony Gwynn helped me a lot coming up through the Padre organization, and then once I got to the big leagues with the Padres, Tony was fantastic. And, you know, it was common sense with Tony talking to me about hitting, and, you know, it makes sense. I mean, if you hit a hard ground ball, it's a lot harder to catch, or a line drive, it's a lot harder to catch than a routine pop-up. So, you know, we tried to keep the ball out of the air as much as we could. We tried to hit it on a line or hard on the ground, and if you happen to get under a little bit, you had a chance of hitting it out, but we never tried to lift balls. But, you know, they've got all this statistical data. I think Daniel Murphy was one of the first guys that I've heard speak about launch angle and hitting the ball in the air, and then it just kind of took off with a lot of these hitting gurus. Now they think that's the way to go, is swing up and try to lift the ball. And, you know, that's great if you're a guy like the size of Ryan Howard or Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge, guys like that. But, you know, if you're a little guy and you don't have much power, man, you better hit the ball on the ground or on a line and take your chances. You still get paid a lot for getting on base a lot.
You know, John, you were classified as what would be a contact hitter. Finished with over a .300 batting average in your career. You don't see that much nowadays. It's sort of like a lost art.
Yeah, it's these general managers now with all these metrics, and they've broken it down to the nth degree of everything statistical-wise with how they run the game and players they look at and players they want to bring in. You know, my thing, and I've spoken to a couple guys who are big into the sabermetrics and all that stuff, and they talk about slugging and on base, the OPS, and how they have OPS plus and all that other stuff that I don't understand. But, you know, my comment to them was, isn't a batting average, if you have a high batting average, isn't that part of on base percentage? You know, if you walk 75 times and you hit 250, your on-base percentage ain't going to be too good. But if you hit 300 and you can still walk a bunch, isn't that part of on-base percentage? That's what the one thing I never got a clear answer from is basically batting average is irrelevant now.
You know, it's crazy because somebody that hits 300 over a career, I mean, baseball's a game of failure. That's a pretty darn good number to hit career-wise. That's 3 out of 10 times you're on base somehow by hitting the ball.
Yeah, that's what my impression of it was, you know, the more hits I got, the more I was going to be on base. You know, kind of adds up that way. Call me stupid, but I think it works that way. But, you know, I had a contest with Tony Gwynn, and I swore to him that I was going to win a batting title and take it from him, and because he won how many in a row, whatever. I mean, every year it seemed like he won one. And but I never did that, but it was always a goal coming into every season. I wanted to hit higher than Tony. I wanted to finish with a higher batting average than Rooney, and that was, you know, being patient, being selective, but being aggressive early in the count and trying to put as many balls in play as you can to give you a chance to get hits. And, you know, it didn't work out because Tony was so much better than I was, believe me. But, you know, that was my goal every year, to try to hit 300 or better, but try to beat Tony. And look, if I was going to beat Tony, I knew I had to hit 315, 320 at the minimum. And it just didn't work out because he was so great. But it was always an ambition of mine, that's what I shot for every year.
John, one of the things that always pops up with baseball fans is National League, American League. You had the privilege of playing a majority in the National League, but also had a stint in the American League with the Chicago White Sox. What league do you like best? Do you like the pitcher hitting or no?
Yeah, I like the National League better. I like the strategy. You know, I think managers are more involved in the game in the National League. You know, there's a lot more situational things that you have to do in the National League offensively to score runs. You know, the American League, when they went to DH, all of a sudden, you know, you could have a guy who was one of the worst fielders in the world, but he could be an MVP candidate because he could hit. And I always thought there were two sides of the field. Like if you go 0-for-4, can you do something defensively to help your team win? You know, that's what I like more about the National League. I talked to managers that have managed in both, and most of those managers that I've spoken to, they enjoyed the National League game more. You know, basically in the American League, besides taking a pitcher out, you don't have to ever worry about a double switch. You know, you can take your pitcher out whenever you feel like it without, trying to get him through an inning because you're going to hit for him the following half inning. So there's really not that much strategy involved in the National or in the American League, and that's what I always thought the game was more fun and more exciting in the National League, just because of the strategy that the managers have to involve themselves in.
Well, John, you said you start your career at San Diego. You're drafted the same year as Tony Gwynn. He's a good friend. He was somebody that you would compete against personally to try and attain that level. But what's it like when you're in the San Diego system and all of a sudden somebody comes to you one day and says, well, John, we're shipping you to Philadelphia? Now, at that point in time, things in Philly weren't exactly roses until club was assembled that you were a part of in 93, and you guys really took off. But what was the feeling knowing that you were leaving the West Coast, coming east to Philadelphia, and thinking, what's going to happen next?
I was happy about it, and the fact that I got traded with Randy Reddy, who was my best, he and Tony were my two best friends on that team, and our teams in San Diego, and when Randy and I got traded together, it was, I was going with my buddy, man. We were leaving. And, I don't want to say we got screwed over by the organization, but, I know for a fact that some people in the front office didn't like me because we didn't dot the I's and cross the T's with all the way that they wanted their team to be, organization to be, and their players to be, as far as, guys that are clean living and, do the right thing and, run my work, not that, far from that. But I remember the first, we got traded when we were in Cincinnati, and Randy and I got a flight the next morning to Philly. And you get like 3 days to report. But we wanted to play because my playing time was diminished for reasons, because Larry Ball wasn't the manager anymore, that's why. And Randy's playing time was diminished too, just because we weren't well thought of with the organization. So we took a flight out the next morning from Cincinnati after the night game and got into Philly. We come in and people were like, what the hell are you guys doing here? You don't need to be here for 3 days. But I mean, it was not a fun place to be when we first got there. I sat down with Lee Thomas when we first got there, and he said, look, this isn't the only trade we're making. We're going to clean house, and we're going to try to get in Philadelphia-style players. And, I know that Bill Giles, after the fact of the trade, Bill was a big proponent of getting me there he tried to get me there for a couple of years prior to being traded there. And Randy, too. He loved our grit. He loved how hard we played and the intensity we play with, and, double-may-care attitude, whatever. So, I remember having long conversations with Berman after we got traded. And, I told Darren, I said, man, this is ridiculous, how just drab that whole atmosphere was in that team. But then the next thing you get Lenny Dykstra, Roger McDowell, then you get Terry Mulholland, Dennis Cook, Charlie Hayes. You're like, okay, wait a second. Now we got something. We got younger, we got more athletic, and we had guys that wanted to put it on the line every day. And that, to me, once that started changing, the culture started changing, and Darren started taking a more leadership role, because you have to remember, I got traded, I think, 2 weeks after Smitty retired. And Smitty was the guy. And so everyone else, when you have a guy like Mike Smith, who's a certain Hall of Famer, you don't rock the boat, you know? You just don't. And when Smitty retired, guys still were like that. You know, Smitty was quiet. Smitty was, you know, went about it, just did what he wanted to do. You know, once some guys got traded and they brought in other guys, I mean, it became Animal House in there, and it was a boatload of fun.
You know, John, you talk about the atmosphere in Philly, and they're known for their ruckus fans and their passionate fan base. And that passionate fan base voted you three-time All-Star.
Yeah, I never got that. You know, to me, it was more, I enjoy playing. And San Diego is a great place, don't get me wrong. I mean, a beautiful city, you know, had everything you could ever ask for living there. Playing there was different. And, you know, I just know when Larry Bowa was the manager in San Diego, we would talk about Philly a lot. And, you know, because we'd go there and play, and, you know, you get booed or whatever, who cares? When Larry got fired, he said, you know, we're going to find a way to get you to the Phillies. I don't know when, but we're going to try to get you. Are you okay with that? I'm like, hell yeah. And I just remember when I got there, Larry and I had a long talk, and Larry said, look, here's the deal. He said, you play the game the right way, but you have to do it every single day here or they're going to let you know. And to me, I was so much more focused. My best years were in Philadelphia because, you know, I was so much more focused every day because, one, I didn't want to let my teammates down. Two, I didn't want to let the fans down. And three, I sure as hell didn't want them to turn on me. And so it was, to me, it was the intensity every single day you took the field at Veterans Stadium. Every day, your ass was on the line, and you better perform.
You know, John, that group became known as Macho Row for a reason. Y'all grew your hair out. Y'all walked with a swagger. And I really want to know how much money you won in the clubhouse playing poker.
I lost. and I lost the Bowa, which really traps me because, you know, you can lose money to people. Like, I would rather lose $10,000 to someone like Darren or someone like that than I would lose a penny to Larry Bowa. Because you're never going to hear the end of it.
You know,
it never ends with him. It never ends with Larry. And that's the beautiful thing of him is he's going to let you know. I remember one year I had a chance to win a batting title. And the last group of the season, I hurt my shoulder. I wasn't swinging good. Every day he would come in and say, hey, Gary Sheffield, Andy Van Slyke did this. You better get a couple tonight. I'm like, holy crap. You know, we're in last place trying to win a, you know, and all he cares about is telling me what the guys in front of me or just behind me were doing in the batting race. He never, it's relentless, that guy.
You know, when you take a walk through that 93 season and you get to the World Series with that group, that's a very special group to the Philadelphia fan base. And some of those guys were characters, and you fit right in. In fact, it was the year after that where you decided to pen a book titled I Ain't an Athlete, Lady. And it was incredible the way that story came out. You said, I'm a baseball player. So there is some kind of a line there, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, you know, people talk about the greatest athletes. Bo Jackson was special, Deion Sanders special, of course, Jim Thorpe. You know, we all know about those, you know, multi-sport guys professionally at the highest level. Brian Jordan actually did it too with the Falcons and the Braves, but and there's been others, of course. But it's funny when you watch, like, you watch a football player throw out a first pitch and it looks awkward. You watch a basketball player throw out the first pitch and it looks awkward. And I'm pretty damn sure that if we went and tried to catch a pass over the middle or tried to score on you know, whoever, Embiid, whoever you want to, you know, whoever you want to try it, it would be futile and it wouldn't happen well. But So I never thought, like, I thought playing football helped me play basketball in high school. Playing basketball helped me with baseball. So I thought every sport helped each other. And, like, baseball to me was not something I really enjoyed as a kid growing up. I enjoyed football and basketball better because there was more action. But baseball just came natural to me. And so that's what I thought. Like, you know, I started thinking, like, I don't even try. Like, I never practice. Like, these, you watch kids now, these teenage kids and little league kids, and, you know, they're hitting, taking 100 swings every day, and they're playing travel ball year-round and whatever in one sport. I'd have quit. If my dad would have said, you're playing travel ball year-round, which we didn't have travel ball back then, thank God. But if he said, if you're playing travel ball year-round, you have to play travel, I'd have quit. I wouldn't have played because that wouldn't have been fun to me because I wanted to do other things, other sports. And so I, like, I don't think you have to be a great athlete to be a really good baseball player. It helps, but, you know, at the end of the day, hand-eye coordination is the thing that does it for you.
You know, John, you talk about the fun and losing the poker to Larry Boa. You hear the stories about Hank Aaron and back in the day with DiMaggio and all of them and swigging beers and eating hot dogs in the clubhouse. What is life like in the clubhouse, and has it really changed that much?
Yes, it's changed a bunch. You know, we had free reign, and, you know, we did stuff in there that, my God, if it happened now with all these phones and, you know, people wanting the big story, you know, we were lucky in Phillies. We had pretty much every guy that covered us, beat writers, men or women, beat writers that covered us. They looked the other way at times, which we were very helpful or very, very happy they did. Today, though, it's everything's so competitive now. And with, you know, how the newspaper industry is with, you know, now with the internet and people aren't buying papers, you know, you have to find something sensational. And that's, you know, when I go into the clubhouse now, and I don't blame the players, they're very guarded because they have to be. A lot of guys ruin the scene in the clubhouse because they're either in the room where they have, you know, the chefs are cooking food for them, lunch room, or they're in the weight room, or they're, you know, they're in the trainer's room. And to be honest with you, I don't blame them one bit because, you know, you say one thing and you can't retract it. I mean, it just, once it hits, it hits, and they're, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, these media people are going to run with it. You know, I really feel bad for the players now because I don't think they could be like they want to be, like young kids, young men having fun playing baseball, making a bunch of money and enjoying the hell out of it, being crazy and stupid. These guys now have to be so much more guarded with everything they do that, you know, people ask me, they said, would you like to be playing now? Can you imagine the money you would make? And I would say no, because, hell, I'd have been kicked out my second year in the big league. They probably kicked me out for some dumb crap I did.
You know, John, not talking about baseball today and the current situation we're in, with baseball being on hold, and I know there's talk about how many different ways they can make these games up. I know doubleheaders has been spoken of, maybe doing seven-inning doubleheaders. You were part of that conversation when the baseball work stoppage occurred. You know, you guys said doubleheaders isn't exactly the answer for our health. Do you think that will be a sticking point in trying to move the season forward in some way or shape?
Well, I think the players would be agreeable to some doubleheaders. You know, I heard maybe seven-inning doubleheaders. You know, that might be a thing. Expanding the rosters because where you could have more players in those doubleheaders would be a thing. Like, I think from 26 to 30, I heard something like that, like bringing like four extra pitchers just in case. I don't think the players would be opposed to it. But, you know, again, like, but where are they going to play? That's the thing, you know, because, you know, I read where the mayor of New York said that they might not have any big crowd events like sporting events, concerts, whatever, till maybe end of July, I heard. So what are the Mets going to do? If they start the season back up, are the Mets and the Yankees going to have to play on the road every day? That's not fair to them. And I don't think baseball can do anything until they figure out what each state is going to do as far as, you know, when they're going to let people go back to work and when they're going to let people basically come out of their house and live what we probably are going to find out is the normal life now. We're still guarded with you know, germs and infection and everything. So I don't really know what baseball can do right now until they find out what each state's going to do.
You know, John, when you take a look at this year's current Phillies roster as it sat when everybody left spring training, anything that you were looking forward to or anticipating out of this year's club?
Yeah, you know, the new guys, Zach Wheeler and Didi Gregorius. I think, you know, Gene Segura was a good shortstop. He made a few errors. Didi, a really, really good shortstop. He's played in that pressure cooker in New York. You know, he was the guy that replaced Derek Jeter, which I'm sure that couldn't have been easy on him at first. But he played, and he put up numbers. And when you saw him and Segura, because, you know, Gene had to move to third base, when you see them two, and Didi and him were, like, inseparable. And that's going to help Segura a lot more, knowing that, you know, he has a guy beside him who he trusts, and moving Scott Kingery back to his normal position of second base, I think, and leaving him there, hopefully, I think that's going to be a big help. And new guy that they got, I mean, you saw once he got hurt, Andrew McCutchen, when he got hurt in San Diego, the Phillies couldn't find a leadoff hitter, and that hurt him, and their offense struggled, you know, after Andrew, you know, was lost for the season. So I think having Andrew back, Andrew healthy, that's going to be a huge help. And, you know, just with the, with DD, you know, it's just going to lengthen the lineup a little more. It's going to add an extra power bat in that lineup, you know, and it's going to do nothing but help Reese and Bryce hitting ahead of him. But what I've talked to Girardi about is, you know, DD will probably hit fifth a lot with Bryce hitting third and Reese hitting fourth. So it's a pretty damn good lineup.
You know, what kind of vibe does Joe Girardi bring to the clubhouse as the new manager in Philly?
Well, a proven winner. You know, he managed in the National League with the Marlins. He won manager of the year, and then they fired him, but that was typical Marlins. But, you know, he's managed in a big city, you know, the biggest city, of course, in New York. He won a world championship with the Yankees managing them. He knows the National League game because not only did he manage, but he played a lot of years in the National League when he's with the Cubs. But I think what Joe brings is he's going to bring a mixture of old-school baseball with new school baseball. So he's going to incorporate his gut when he's making decisions on pitchers, pinch hitters, double switches. But he's also going to have numbers to go with it also. But the first time I saw him this spring, I went up there to Clearwater, and I probably talked to him for about a half hour, 45 minutes, and we talked baseball. And it was just so refreshing to talk baseball. No one brought up, none of us brought up numbers, exit velocity, OPS plus, WOBA, and all that other stuff. And trust me, I have no clue what any of it is. But we just talked baseball. And he talked about Didi. He talked about Segura. He talked about Kingery. It was just fun listening to the manager talk baseball. And it was refreshing. And I thought to myself, wow, they got the right guy.
John, you know, going back, I mean, you're a young kid growing up in West Virginia. You come out of a community college. You're the first one ever drafted out of the community college to go on to play pro ball. Some players followed in your footsteps. I mean, you put a spotlight into that community college, and they said, hey, listen, John Kruk came from there. We better take that as a serious spot to start looking. I mean, did you imagine any of this? You know, John Kruk, the first baseman, you know, with the Padres, with the Phillies, with the White Sox, then on ESPN, the best damn sports show, period. And now back with the Phillies as an analyst. Did you ever picture this when you were 6 or 7 years old?
Oh, no. No, I had no clue. I actually went to the junior college I went to play to play basketball. So I never got I wasn't never a big fan of baseball. I don't know, maybe because it came so naturally to me. But I went there to play basketball. The right fielder on the baseball team blew out his knee playing football that fall. The coach kept coming, asked me to come play. Why don't you come play? And finally, I gave in and said, sure, I'll try it. And, you know, next thing I know, I see these gentlemen behind home plate at some of our games. And I asked one guy, I said, who are those people? I got like stopwatches and radar gun and pad and paper. I said, who the hell are those people? And they said, oh, those are scouts. I said, what do you mean scouts? They said, well, the one guy's with the Reds, one guy's with the Yankees, one guy's with the Dodgers, one guy's, I'm like, holy crap, really? That's the hell they want to watch us for. And, lo and behold, one of the guys on the team that was a year older than me, he was a sophomore when I got there. You know, he ended up getting drafted by the Yankees. Our shortstop got drafted by the Dodgers. We had a couple other guys that got drafted or whatever. And I had a really good year. And I'm like, wow, this could be something interesting. And lo and behold, I got drafted. I actually got drafted by the Pirates in the winter. They had a winter draft back then. And when I went and met with the people from the Pirates, they were like, they turned me off of baseball, to be honest with you. You know, basically said, we're going to send you down to Bradenton. They showed me brochures of the beaches in Bradenton and, you know, girls in bikinis and whatever. And I'm like, wait a second. I said, I thought I was going down there to play baseball. And he said, well, this is what he said. And he said, we're going to send you down there because I was kind of local to Pittsburgh. You know, I grew up about 3 hours from there, so they considered that local to Pittsburgh. And they said, we're going to send you down there, and then when spring training's over, we're going to send you home. And I'm like, wow, okay. That doesn't, and my dad was with me because I don't even know if I was 18. I might have just turned 18. No, it was I think I just turned 18 maybe. So my dad went with me because, I mean, I was clueless. And, you know, knowing my dad, he was more clueless than me, but you know, when he said that, my dad just looked at him and he said, you can go, you know what, to yourself. And he walked out of the room. And so I'm sitting there with this guy and he said, well, what do you think? I said, you heard it. Go whatever yourself. So we get in the car, we're driving home. And I said, hey, I said, what happens if I don't get drafted again? He goes, I guess that's on you now, isn't it? I'm like, oh, boy, no pressure here. But so then I got drafted again. I ended up going to a summer league and playing the first time I ever played really in a summer league. And it was all four-year kids, you know, and I think I was the only junior college guy in the league. And it just so happened that pitcher on the team got drafted by the Reds in June, and I got drafted by the Padres. And, you know, we both said, if we get drafted, we're going. And, you know, the other guy was Tom Browning, the pitcher that got drafted with Tom Browning, who had a great career with the Reds. And so we left, I was clueless. Like, I didn't know there was minor leagues. And to be honest with you, if people think, oh, how did you not know that? I didn't even know San Diego, like, had a team. Because, we watch playoffs and World Series. That's the only games we could get, you know, because we didn't really have cable. And we got the game of the week, and the Padres were never on that, and they never made the playoffs, so I didn't even know they existed. I always thought there was only two teams, Yankees, Dodgers, like in the 70s. That seemed like the only two teams in the world.
John, you know, you talk about the minor leagues and not knowing, but, I mean, a big thing now is, you know, they're looking to cut the minor leagues down by quite a few hundred teams, and, I mean, a lot of people use that as a crutch for baseball, I mean, and development, but it's also family fun atmosphere and affordable entertainment for a lot of people.
Well, and it is going to hurt some of those cities, too, and that, if baseball does that, I not that they care what I think, but I'm going to be really pissed, because I think it's look at the people you would never have seen play. You wouldn't have seen Mike Piazza play if they only have X amount of teams. He would have never got drafted. Hall of Famer. You got a lot of guys. Myself, I would have never played in the big leagues if they didn't have five minor league teams in the Padre organization. It doesn't make sense. I get it that the big league teams fund a lot of the minor leagues and as far as players pay and all that stuff. But, man, I mean, you know, you talk about a hit to the economy of some of these towns. I mean, some of these towns, that's it. Some of these smaller towns. And, you know, I just can't imagine how baseball can look at this and say, yeah, this is a good idea, because it's really a stupid idea as far as I'm concerned.
Correct. You know, the folks in our listening audience, it's an hour, 45 minutes to an hour down the road to Reading, which is Baseball Town USA, which is one of the greatest minor league experiences you can find.
Yeah, they do it right there. And I've become friends with Scott Huntsinger and Chuck Domino and those guys. They do it right in Reading. But can you imagine if something happened that they said, well, we're going to take Reading out of the equation? That might be a conversation, that a private conversation between me and Rod Manfred that he might not like. But I just don't think it's a good idea. You know, you got a lot of baseball lifers. A buddy of mine down here played in the minor league organization. He played in the minor leagues for 4 or 5 years. He was a minor league hitting coach, catching coach, manager. He got to the big leagues for when Paul Molitor got named the manager of the Twins. He got to the big leagues to coach a few years. And I just talked to him the other day, and he's in A-ball now with Tampa Bay, was going to manage their A-ball team. And they're talking about getting rid of that team. He won't have a job. And this guy's not only is he one of the nicest guys, he's smart as hell, baseball-wise, and he's a great communicator. It would just be sickening. Some of these guys who are baseball lifers, who all of a sudden you're just basically saying, yeah, we're going to get rid of you. We're going to do away with your team, so you guys can't do anything.
Yeah, that's tough. That's very tough. You know, you say baseball comes naturally to you, John. It seems like the broadcast booth has been a natural fit for you, because I'll tell you what, when you're with the Phillies for the night, that is one of the most enjoyable times of my day, is to sit and listen to you analyze what's going on the field. And you're brutally honest. Without the product in your hair like Ben Davis, you get the job done, and it's enjoyable and fun.
Well, this pandemic's got my hair a little shorter. I bumped the Clippers out the other day. It was getting a little shaggy, and apparently I used the wrong guard, they told me. Uh-huh. My kids told me. And so I'm pretty much, it's a crew cut. If crew cuts are really short, that's what I have. But, you know, I was always told, like when I started at ESPN and I did a game, they had me do a game here and there. And, you know, I was told by a guy at ESPN, he said, and Dan Strowman was like this, and now Tom McCarthy's like this, and, you know, the guys I did games with were play-by-play guys. And they said, look, we will get the numbers, You know, don't cloud your mind with, well, with runners in scoring position on Sundays at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He's, you know, he said, we'll do that crap. He said, you just tell us what you see. Because he said, you played at the highest level. You were successful at that level. So you will see things differently than the average viewer. And I said, well, yeah, at some point. But, and that's, you know, I will, trust me, I will never come off like, oh, I'm the smartest guy in the world here, and I know more baseball because I played. There's so many good people who haven't played that are good broadcasters, you know, because they study the game, they understand the game. But I always thought, you know, if I can impart, you know, in this situation, I would have tried to do this or I would have tried to do that. I think that, to me, is what I was told by Dan and T-Mac, was, you know, just tell us what you see and your experience of what you see and what could have been right or what could have been wrong about it. So to me, it's pretty easy. I've never been, you know, where we grew up, with, you know, if someone did something stupid, you said it. You told them. If someone did something good, you praised them. So we don't sugarcoat crap back where I grew up, and I can't do it here either.
Well, John, don't sugarcoat this next answer. Citizens Bank Ballpark or the Vet?
Well, I'd rather play the Citizens Bank. It's one, it has grass, which could have saved a few of the surgeries I had on my knees. And the ball flies out of there. And it's a great atmosphere to watch games. But, you know, I've talked to a few of the current players about, you know, what the, you know, because they'll ask, like, what was the Vet like? And it could be a quiet, docile place when you stink. But, man, I every night I left 93 about halfway through the year until the World Series was over. I never played a game there where I didn't get a headache because it was so loud, because it's, you know, it's enclosed. So it was so loud down there. It was like, I'd go to pitcher, talk to pitcher, and they couldn't even hear me. You have to scream at them. But man, by the end of the day, by the time the game's over, you had a headache. It's a headache I will take every single day, because those people were, they rocked that place. So I would like the atmosphere. But again, the atmosphere in 2007, 2008, 2009, you know, with Jimmy and Chase and Ryan and Cole and all those guys, you know, that was electric too at Citizens Bank, because I got to cover the World Series for ESPN in 2008. So that place was loud, but man, it's nothing like the Vet. Nothing.
Well, John, we don't want to keep you much longer this morning here on the program, but we got to thank you for your honesty and your journalism now, and your honesty here with us this morning on just everything baseball and talking about you. And we appreciate you taking time out to join us and let our listeners know what the life and times and current situation is with John Kruk.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad I could enlighten some people.
Well, Doc, there you have it. John Kruk joining us on the program here this morning, and we'll take a time out. We'll come back and wrap the show up and get on out of here on this Saturday morning on AM 1360, 106 FM, and around the world at WPPARadio.com.